G-Pots, I seem to have developed this bad habit of standing in front of my slides, and the audience developed a bad habit of not telling me, so please tell me if I'm blocking. Okay. All right. Some of you have heard pieces of this before, but I have 50 minutes now, so I'll expand it. I'll be able to explain some of it better and maybe cover all of it. I'll be skipping a section in the middle, which I'll just advertise, and that'll be handled by Victor on Friday. So anyways, joint work with Victor, and it's developed sort of like we're trying to move forward from my project with Dyke, Figiel, and Wojcicki, which all or most of you have heard about and heard me speak on, at least occasionally. But let me start slow and methodical and try to explain the real basics. Maybe I'll have a better feel for what's coming. The whole purpose of this is to give you a feel for the kind of objects that are occurring in this study. Not so much techniques, although there's a little bit of technique in it, just to give you a flavor of that. So I'm going to try to answer, well, I'm dealing with these four questions. I won't have any luck on four. I think that's where we're headed. Perhaps a little bit of luck on four, but that's like, again, the general goal. But we're going to talk about one, two, and three in detail and hopefully get somewhere on it. First, what is a trace and what's it good for? Traces are unitarily invariant linear functionals on an ideal, two-sided ideal always, and B of H, H separable. And the ideals, two-sided ideals, are natural domains for traces. And the best example, perhaps the only example early on, was the standard trace acting on, that's what we call the trace class. They like the L1 notation, Dyke, Figiel, and Wojcicki, because it sort of fits more naturally with other ideals. But anyway, and then question two, what ideals possess a trace? What kinds of traces? Why? And here's a list of various kinds of properties traces can have. Singular, non-singular, positive, faithful, continuous, spectral. I'll deal with the first two in this talk. I don't know a whole lot about the later ones. We know a little. I know a little. Some of the other boys know more. When can a trace be extended from an ideal inside another ideal all the way out to the bigger ideal? And question three, when is a trace unique? Well, never, because you can always multiply by a scalar. But up to that, it can be unique, up to multiplication by scalar. So can you decide? And if not unique, can you decide how many? And there's a conjecture related to that. Now, it's easy in vector space. These are just algebraic vector spaces now, these quotients, that the dual of this quotient is isometric, is a nice simple connection, isometry between that, isomorphism between that and the other quotient, so that those two dimensions are equal as linear spaces over C. And just for those who might be new to the subject, this thing on the bottom, that's the commutator space, some of us call it, but the traditional name for it is commutator ideal, and it's not an ideal in B of H. What it is a Lie ideal. Okay. So anyway, what it is the linear span, equivalently the all possible linear sums, finite sums, of I, B of H commutators. Those are AB minus BA, where A is an I and B is in B of H. And then 4, again, is to characterize or try to classify all the tau's on a fixed ideal and do that for all ideals. So, I mean, that's probably never going to happen, but you can do it for the important ones, perhaps. And again, relative to these types of ideals, characterize a singulars and non-singulars and so forth. Okay, so I'm going to take these in order. One, each linear functional, good, I love it. Is that right today, that clock? Okay. Okay. For each linear functional on an ideal I, the following are equivalent. It's unitarily invariant, and it maps the commutator ideal, commutator space, to zero. So you start out with it being a linear functional, and you insist that it map that subspace of I to zero. And that's equivalent. And that is a strong connection between commutators and unitarily invariant traces. That's the connection, and I'll explain it a little further. It goes a little further. And here's a short proof. I asked the question yesterday of Alan, and I was a little bit confused because I hadn't worked in the Lie ideals. So this proof doesn't work in Lie ideals. This is the point, but here it works. And that is that commutator is T minus UT star. So any tau that annihilates the commutator, see, when T, when you have an ideal and T is in the ideal, so is UT for a unitary U. Okay, and so now you're taking UT as in the idea is an I, and U star is in B of H, and the commutator has to have trace zero. So that tells you that tau of T minus tau of UT U star is zero, and that means unitary invariance. The other direction, you need to just, that's an easy proof, just you need to use the fact that every B is a linear, every bounded operator is a linear combination of four unitaries. That gets that for you easily. So, there's a problem here, but I'm going to pretend we know it for a little bit until the next slide, about whether or not this map on the quotient, lambda defined on T plus IB of H is tau of T. Whether or not that's well defined. The point, of course, is that T plus that the commutator ideal can have several representatives T, and how do you know that tau of T is the same on both? So now you follow this through and you can see the isomorphism here. So any linear functional on that quotient then establishes a linear function. That's the algebraic dual, of course, again. A linear isomorphism between the class of traces on I and this space, which is a nice elementary linear space, elementary in a sense, from the abstract point of view. And the liftability of lambda here from the quotient to all of I is defined this way, would do the job, and that would establish your linear isomorphism between the class of traces and a dual. And that also tells you that finding out the dimension of the quotient is the way to count the traces. Okay, now, things get a little more complicated, but this is a useful complication. There's an alternate view of traces. And this alternate view will help define the two categories of singular and non-singular. Okay, it requires a notion of trace extensions. I described a little bit before. You have an ideal inside I, and you have a trace living on J, say, and J, a trace living on J, and you want to extend it to all of I. Well, the point is that every ideal contains the finite ranks. That's the smallest proper ideal, and the two-side ideal. And so every trace on I automatically lives on F. And is, again, a linear functional and unitarily invariant and all of that. So every trace is really a trace extension from F. Now, on F, the values of tau are completely determined by the action of tau on P. That's using unitary invariance and linearity and simple things. And so the restriction of tau to the finite ranks is just a scalar multiple of the standard trace. Okay, now depending on that multiple, determines whether which class of singulars are when the C is zero. So those are the traces that vanish on the finite ranks. And the traces that don't, that's when C is not zero. C, by the way, if you plug in, is simply what tau is on that operator P. That's what C is. So if tau of P is zero, then you have a singular trace. And if tau of P is not zero, then you have a non-singular trace. So far, this is just a skeleton of a subject that might not have any importance if you couldn't find out any other information. I imagine you could write this down on a slide in 1930. But then Dixmier came along in 66, maybe earlier. I don't know when the trace first occurred as a formal object. Does anybody know the history of the trace class and the trace? Does it go back to the 1800s or earlier? I don't know. But anyway, just the place to ask. Gattison once told me that this was a big deal in its time. I guess I was living, but I didn't know anything. So, anyway, he proved the existence of Dixmier proved the existence of a positive singular trace on this S omega. I'm probably going to call it C. Victor and I are always fighting about this, but it's formally I think it's an S. And we even commented on one of our papers, Bojitski does, about the history of the symbol and how it got lost and probably started being called C because people didn't know how to pronounce it. But anyway, S omega is this thing, And here you can see the summation of the initial parts of a sequence arise here. And I'll say more about what sigma is. I have to talk about the Kalkin representation of ideals, and that most of you know that, if not all. I'll say something more about it. But in any case, that's what it takes to define S omega, and it's a dual of the Masayev ideal, which is somewhat well known. And again, Dixmier's result was construction was a little more general. And then here's a little bit of sort of a current statements about the various symbols used by different people who use these ideals. Kahn's uses it. Wojtylewski uses it. He's not in the list. Goldberg-Krein is GK. So it's undergone lots of names. Okay. But the point here is, first of all, Varga sort of presented a kind of a result in 89 as a paper which is very important for the study, in which he determines the traceable ideals, traceable principle ideals. And that's if and only if the generator is irregular. Now, wait a second. You take an operator, a compact operator generates is what you need to generate a principle ideal. That's the smallest principle ideal containing it. And what I mean by irregular generator is you take the operator, you take its S number sequence, and that has to be an irregular sequence. And I'll tell you here, remind you later, but a sequence, okay, you're always talking about a decreasing sequence to zero. The S numbers are that for compact operators. That's a sequence XN. I like to write them more simply that way. Then you have the averaging sequence, which is X1 up to XN divided by N. That's a sequence itself as well. And this is certainly always true. But sometimes X sub A is big O of X, and that's regularity. And a nice way to say that is equivalence. So these are the regular sequences. The irregular sequences is where that's not the case. And that's the requirement for the S numbers of your operator to be, that's what I mean by irregular. And so, again, Varga proved that when you have irregular, if and only if the principal ideal is traceable. Traceable means non-zero trace. Zero is always trace. Okay, so... And non-singular is otherwise, that's when the C equals T tau P, and that's not zero, and the dimension of the quotient, tau divided by the singulars is always one, that you know right away, and so that comes to this very sort of common thing in ODEs, that the non-singular trace, tau is always a multiple of a particular non-singular plus some singular, the C is that relation. And so the non-singulars is always a constant multiple of a particular plus a singulars. The tau p exists precisely when the harmonic sequence, we call it omega, that's 1 over n, is not in I. What I mean by that is the diagonal with those entries along it is not in I. I'll just say this for short. And I'll show you a little bit later how the main theorem in the Dykema, Figel, Wojcicki, and me paper, the theorem will be on one of the later slides, and I'll show you how that comes out. But in any case, what this says, then, is that characterizing all traces reduces to characterizing only the singular ones if omega is an I, or either the non-singular ones or the singular ones plus one particular one when omega is not an I. So the non-singulars and the singulars are really very much, very, very, very similar when you have a non-singular. Okay, so there's a few statements. There's existence, the non-singular and the singular. Here are conditions. The following are equivalent. Existence of a trace. I is not, the numerator is different than the denominator in that quotient. And so it's essential to understand the structure of the commutator space, the commutator ideal, IB of H. That is in particular to determine if there's a single operator that's in I that's not in a commutator ideal. So you have to understand somehow you need a structure theorem for those things. Okay? And that's historically what obstructed kept any of this stuff from happening. And three, this comes out of, again, the project with Dykema, Figel, and Wojcicki, that I is not equal to I sub A, so I'm introducing I sub A here. This is the ideal generated by the diagonal operators of averages of elements in I. Those are averages. That's the averaging sequence. And I sub A is the ideal generated by it. Here's another definition in black. And for I to be different from I sub A, that's necessary and sufficient. So condition two, you got to know about commutators of operators, and it's a highly non-commutative issue. But in condition three, it's a totally an analysis issue. You have to understand the elements of the ideal, the kinds of S numbers that appear in it, and you have to look at the averages of that and see is it the same class or not. That's an analysis question. So early on, you saw we had something that's purely algebraic, then we get into operator theory, non-commutative business, and now we're back to commutative setting and analysis, so in fact, analysis on sequences. And they're all connected, and you'll see lots of things arise here, results and questions and so forth. For the non-singular fellows, the following equivalent, there exists one. The standard trace on F extends to tau on I. So that's the very special trace, extends. The rank one projection operator is not an element in there, in the commutator ideal. And that's a result, again, of that theorem one, which is coming in a slide or two. And four, that omega, that is a diagonal omega, is not contained in your ideal. Those are all equivalent for non-singular. For singular only, any two of those guys. I is not I B of H, or equivalently I is not I of A, and omega is an I, or P is an I B of H. Okay, so that's about existence. So now we've talked about what singular and non-singular is, and we haven't done the others, more or less. Of course, you all know what positive is, probably. And the interesting thing is Dixmier's first example was also positive. Okay, so the extension process, again, you have tau living on J, which sits inside of I, and you want to extend it to all of I. Some desirable special cases that give you a feel of why you'd want to do this is extending 0 from F to I. Okay, that would get you a non-singular trace. 0 from the trace class to I, if I happens to contain the trace class, often doesn't, often it does. Some of the most interesting ideals are the ones that contain the trace class, I think. The standard trace extends from F to I, and the standard trace extends from L1 to I if I happens to contain L1. And those four cases come up a lot. Of course, there are others. Okay, now we'll see the business about well-defined. Okay, first, we're going to extend from J to this larger subspace, J plus the commutator ideal. Now, how do you do that? It's forced. J plus C must be sent into tau of J plus tau of C, which is 0. That is tau of J. So the hard part, then, is to realize that there's the well-definedness issue about J. If J plus C is J prime plus C prime, C for commutator, J for element of J, then when you act on it with tau, how do you know tau of J and tau of J prime are equal? To decide that, just take the difference. You see that J minus J prime equals C prime minus C. That lies both in J, because J is an ideal, and lies in the commutator ideal, because that's a starred linear space. Well, linear here is all you need. Okay, so in order for tau J to be tau J prime, you need tau of J minus J prime to be 0. That is to say, think a little bit further, but the logic is pretty clear, that tau has to send this intersection. Any operator that's both in J and in the commutator ideal has to get sent to 0. In order to decide whether that happens, you need to understand two things reasonably well: the structure of the commutator ideal and how tau behaves on it. Now, generally, early on, our tau was usually the trace, so we could tell. But that's what you need to tell. Now, how do you get further, all the way out to I? Because there's stuff left. Well, that's easy. That's trivial, actually. All you do is complete that subspace via a Hummel basis all the way out to I, and you define tau any way you like. There's no interference, no obstructions. It just goes automatic. So it's highly non-unique taus that one can create then. The hard part's getting out to J plus the commutator ideal, and that requires the theory. That is characterizations of I, B of H, and so forth. So, whenever you can go past I plus the commutator ideal, you have plenty of them. So uniqueness is precisely when I is J plus I B of H, and there are cases for that, and we'll talk about that. Now let's look at some examples. The trace extends from F to I if and only if omega is not in I. Mentioned that earlier. Same condition for L1 in I. That is, omega is not in I. That's when I happens to contain L1. And so here is a rather nice sort of thing. We had a paper before, sort of preliminary paper, which appeared in the proceedings of a Mexican conference, where we proved this in a relatively elementary way, but still based upon the techniques, we being Dykema Figuel myself, that the trace extends from F and even from L1 all the way out to this little o of 1 over n. Again, these are the operators whose F numbers are little o of 1 over n. That's what I mean by that. That's an ideal. And that contains the trace class. And if there's any graduates here, you may not know this. Probably you do. I didn't know it as a graduate student. But that comes from the fact that if a sequence is summable and decreasing, then xn is little o of 1 over n. Actually, big O of 1 over n. No, little o of 1 over n. By the way, that's the minimum sequence with that property in the big O sense. And that sort of started, in a way, the study at the end of this talk, that fact. But okay, that's what you need here. And so you may not have known it, but you can actually extend the trace past the trace class out to lots of ideals. Anyone that doesn't contain omega, but this one doesn't. Okay, it can't be positive. You can prove that immediately. So you can't hope to get any positivity past the trace class with TR. Now here's the proof. And I'm going to use the proof to describe the theorem, the main theorem of the FWW. Okay. So again, you have to show that the trace goes from this intersection to zero. And let's assume not. So assume you have a finite rank or even a trace class operator, if you want to do it for L1. Which is a commutator, which is in the commutator ideal, the standard trace, when you act on it with the standard trace, is not zero. Okay, now let me explain the theorem. The theorem says for any proper ideal I, and X is X is an I and normal. This will tell you with normal. We really care about the self-adjoints, but elements of I that are normal. Are in the commutator ideal, if and only if, you take X and you diagonalize it, and you arrange the diagonal in monotone order of modulus. So they're complex numbers, real if X is self-adjoint, and you arrange them with decreasing moduli, and then you take the arithmetic mean. So this sequence itself could have some negative entries. Later in our talk, nothing will have negative entries practically. But, okay, right now these could have their negative entries, and you want to decide whether or not this is in the, this means the diagonal is in the ideal or the sequence itself is in the Kalkin, ideal, the characteristic set, I mean, Kalkin's characteristic set of the ideal. Again, I'll say a little bit about that in a later slide. But in any case, that's the criteria. So it's a complete characterization of all of the normal elements in here, all the self-adjoint elements, and therefore, all the operators, because an operator is, this is a starred linear space. It's easy to see that. So X plus or minus X star, X is in it if and only if X plus or minus X star are both in it, in the commutator ideal and so forth. So it all works out very easily and naturally. And this is the criteria for membership when you're self-adjoint. Now, the theorem is quite a bit more general. You can put any J here that you want. And then the condition is that this thing be in IJ. And we found that the ideals form, has a lot of nice structure. They form their own algebra. And you have product of ideals. IJ is a new ideal. And it's, in fact, it's a commutative thing. IJ equals JI. In fact, there's a nice lemma that says anything in the product is really just a product of an operator is equal or dominated by. I think dominated by a product of an operator in I and an operator in J. That's a useful lemma, but anyway, it's not important here. Now, for those who care about counting, back in the 70s in my thesis, I think I found eight or six, probably it was six, I couldn't remember, you don't need to have a million commutators to express an operator in the commutator ideal. You could get it down to, I think, six. But then DFWW gets it down to, I think it's three in many cases, in all cases, I think. And then under fairly general conditions, two, and that there's an example of not one. Okay, so those who care about numbers, there's some techniques in there that actually reduce the number of commutators needed. There's still questions open about single commutators, by the way. People who are looking for problems in commutators and find that they have some intuition there. Let me say a little more about that here. Okay, so the history of commutator ideals. Early on, it was done for I and J, B of H, K, Schotten ideals, and so forth. Heisenberg started it, I guess. I mean, lots of people know a little bit of the story. Vintner, Veelen, Helmholtz, Piercy, Topping, me, Salinas, Anderson, Brown, Colton. And I'll tell you what a little bit of the contributors here, which ones contributed here to this area. That's just general commutator theory. Okay, well, the first action, I think, to arise in terms of show that something was going on that people didn't understand, that I didn't understand, was that you could have that trace being zero did not guarantee membership in the commutator ideal. That is to say, the commutator ideal was contained in the kernel of trace, but not equal to it. Okay, everybody knows that the trace of a commutator of a trace class with a B of H operator is zero, and therefore for the linear span of those. But it was a question in a Piercy Topping paper, I think of 71, I think, whether that was went the other way. And this is a theorem of mine back in the 70s, and actually, Ken gets his hand in everything. He was in on this at the beginning. I got stuck on an optimization question, which he helped me over, which turned out to belong to Fahn. I found that years later when I was looking more closely at Goldberg and Krein. But in any case, this is the first action that there's something going on. That is, characterize the diagonal operators that were that way. Again, these x's are decreasing, by the way, and sum to one, so it's a trace zero operator. And that is a linear, that's in the linear span of those guys, if and only if the summation of log n xn is finite. So there's some kind of logarithmic phenomena going on there, and the whole thing, I think, what a lot of this later theory does is exploit that. Now, if you actually take this theorem with the arithmetic means, and you take the arithmetic mean of those things, and you take the L1 norm, that's what this is. So Colton came along and exploited that all the way and characterized completely that class and showed that every element of it was representable by six or less. And he saw that arithmetic means were the way to go. And so that's the motivation for us. Now we switch to operator theory, basic operator theory, and show you how you can use some of this stuff. Okay, here's an elementary operator. Since we're playing number games, I mean, you got me thinking about this yesterday. I don't know what the answer is, but does anybody know if there are operators that are, is there a limit on how big n can be? I don't know. I don't know how interesting that is, but I never thought about it, what the ramifications would be. I have a paper where n could be infinity, and what happens if you don't need infinity? I don't know. There are issues with keeping control of the monomials and the growth and so forth. So in that paper, I insist that those monomials have absolutely summable norm, the AITBIs. But anyway, if you can get delta p as an elementary operator, if you can get an operator x as equal to delta p for some t, the question is, can you restrict n? Is there some, for example, is there a Marcoux bare category that limits it, that shows there's some universal guy? And then if there is, whether or not there is, can you limit n, like is it 8? I don't know. Okay, So elementary operators, and that's the adjoint, and I don't know exactly why they call it the adjoint, except when you restrict it to the Hilbert-Schmidt class, and you identify the Hilbert-Schmidt class as the Hilbert space itself with the usual inner product using trace, then that actually is the adjoint. But of course, you apply it to other things besides Hilbert-Schmidt operators T, and well, anyway, that's what we call the adjoint. So elementary operators include commutators, intertwiners. Intertwiners are AB minus, AT minus TB, and so forth. And so, their theory is connected to commutator spaces, naturally. But actually, it's connected more than I thought, and you'll see in the following application. So Fugler's theorem, probably everybody knows, but just to remind you, that if del T looks like that, where A and B are normal, then the L del T is 0 implies del star T. And already several decades old result of mine is in N equals 2. If AI and BI are separately commuting families of normal operators, then if del T is Hilbert-Schmidt, so is this the adjoint. And then when that happens, the Hilbert-Schmidt norms are equal. A little while after I found this, Flickalescu came out with his every normal operator is diagonalizable plus Hilbert-Schmidt, and that provided a very easy path. That's not easy, but it makes it all this result almost immediate. But that was only for n less than or equal to 2. For bigger n, it was unknown, although I didn't say it here. But if you happen to know that both of these are Hilbert-Schmidt, then they have to have Hilbert-Schmidt norm no matter what size n is, even if it's infinity, under the right convergence hypotheses. Shulman, in 83, has a counterexample to this. And that's where it stood for a long time, okay, until this project. So if you introduce additional ideal type conditions on del and or t, then you can get arbitrary n past Shulman's obstruction and past limitations of Wojtylescu, and you'll see that happen in a minute. So, again, we need to assume that the identity doesn't contain omega. I'm sorry, the ideal doesn't contain omega. And we need to assume that if you take the ideal generated by AIT, so T doesn't need to be compact, but AIT does, and you take the principal ideal generated by that, and you take the product of those two ideals with BI. Okay, now BI, the ideal generated by BI could be B of H. I'm not saying that's even a proper ideal, but the product is proper. That lies inside of the square root of some ideal. Could be the ideal. Actually, the ideal is going to have to be the sum of those. That'll be the minimum one we're talking about. But any ideal that contains these, this is what the statement's about. And you don't need that order. You could have the other order. So you need to say something about each monomial. So you're not ignoring the monomial the way we tried to do for the general theory. You need to require something. But here, the goal here is the conditions allow I to be much larger than the trace class and some things historically. So these are improvements to other results. Anyway, then there's this really curious identity that comes out of Theorem 1 that says the commutator ideal of I with J is exactly the same as the commutator ideal of IJ with B of H. And a bunch of us were hunting for a proof of that for a few years and could never discover it. And we don't know an easy proof of that even now. But it does come out of Theorem 1. Anyway, if you do a computation and you use that in a careful way, you can actually get this difference to be in the commutator space. So, of course, any trace, including if it's TR or an extension of TR, acting on I, will have to annihilate that difference, and the trace of those two will be the same. And you can see the Hilbert-Schmidt norm arising there. So what that proves, then, is that if you have a Hilbert-Schmidt operator, then del star 2 is actually in here. And then a result of Victor and mine in our project is that this class is that under the hypothesis about omega up there. And from that, we get that for free, and that the Hilbert-Schmidt norms are the same. That via the extension business of TR out to I, and then pull back. So there you see a little bit of technique. Now, in the same vein, there's an operator theory question of Shulman, in which he's trying to get a kind of distribution theory going. And you can sort of see that happening in this question. Again, here, AI and BI are not necessarily commuting nor normal. But his condition is if you act del star del, so you're acting on B or H with this elementary operator, and this looks like a positive kind of guy, but it's, again, there are limitations because you're not really acting on a Hilbert space. But anyway, if that's zero, he knows that that does not imply that del T is zero, but he did ask what happens if del T happens to be Hilbert Schmidt. So if sort of half of that, the inside part, is more controlled, is there some action going on in the distribution theory kind of sense? At least that's my spin on it. Reasoning it as above, you can get a similar kind of calculation going, and you can show that that thing is in the commutator ideal. And so under those conditions, you don't even need the hypothesis that del T is L2. So this must bypass his counterexample. Invalidate it, just it must not include it. But you don't even need that to be able to get all this to happen, and that's the result, that if del star del T is an L1 even, not just 0 but L1, then del T is an L2, and the Hilbert-Schmidt norm squared is that trace of that thing, okay, and that thing, is a trace of that thing, and you can take the trace because this is assumed to be an L1, so T star times it is again an L1 trace class, and in particular, you get this thing true even without the hypothesis that del T is an L2. So here are some classical type of operator theoretic types of conclusions one can draw from these methods and these results. Okay. Okay, now we come to question three. Again, some of this is reviewed by now in this talk, but just to put it in this context, there's no trace if the dimension is zero. That's if I equals the commutator ideal, and that's if and only if I equals I, the averaging ideal, and again, there's the averaging ideal. Uniqueness is when the dimension is one, and as I pointed out, in the non-singular case, you have if and only if I equals F plus IB of H, and that's if and only if TR extends uniquely to I. Okay. Now, F is not in IB of H from existence, and then there's some softness stuff below. That's heading into Victor's area. I'll say a little bit about that. But anyway, let me not dwell on that. Time's running, moving. Let me talk about Theorem 3. There's this fascinating ideal that I love. We named it IMAX informally. It doesn't appear in the paper that way, but anyway. And it's this ideal. It's the S numbers of its operators is satisfy this condition for all p, the xn's of the s numbers, and you have to have lie in all those weighted L1 spaces. And it has this property: any ideal that's not in it has this codimension, I should call it, equal to infinity. What we're doing is we're heading to this conjecture. This is really a conjecture which I think Vojitsky subscribes to as well. Last time I talked to him, I haven't heard from him in a while regarding it. But it seems that with all the classical ideals, and I'll list some of them for you with names of known folks that you know, it's true. That is, the dimension of the number of traces is either 0, 1, or infinity. In a non-singular case, you can only get 1 or infinity, and in a singular case, 0 infinity. That's what the conjecture is. Okay, and again, this holds for all ideals we have found in the literature, and that's what IMAX is. It has this property. So IMAX is the what? It's the largest ideal with a unique non-singular trace. And by the way, it has no singular traces. So you can tell a lot. Okay. Now, there's this tail condition, which also comes out of DFWW. When you're in DFWW, then the ideal is contained in L1. It's automatic. I'm sorry. Uniqueness. If you have uniqueness, then the ideal is contained in L1 is automatic. And the criteria you need to look at, the animal you need to look at to study that is not the that average, but you have to look some. This is not an average, of course. This is an infinite sum. But you look at the tail sums and divide by n. So you look at the tail sum from n plus 1 to infinity, divide by n, and you decide whether that is in I or not, and that tells you things about a membership as well. And so this is the condition here. So you have a unique non-singular trace if and only if I is invariant under the arithmetic mean in infinity. That's what that is, and that means this. So there's a nice characterization of uniqueness in terms of tails. And that's if and only if I as an L1 and the commutator space contains all tray zero operators in I. So there's a case where those are the situations where the tray zero is the thing that is all that matters. Okay, now let me give you an ideal overview. And this is stepping a little bit on Victor, but I'm not going to do too much. Victor say ouch when it gets hurts too much. But this is more advertisement. First, the stuff I want you to hear. Again, every ideal sits between the finite ranks and the compacts, compacts being the only closed, and also it's a maximal, the maximal two-sided ideal in B of H. And Calkin says that every ideal can be associated with its characteristic set sigma of I, which is a set of S numbers. S of X is a sequence of S numbers. And you can tell which kinds of sets, subsets, oh, C0 star are the decreasing sequences to zero. So you can tell what kind of subsets of that are come from ideals via this map. This is a lattice preserving map. One-to-one onto lattice isomorphism. Then it's and it's the sequences that are closed under addition. I said positive. I don't know why I said that. I meant closed under addition, solid, and D2 invariant. D2 is the ampliation operator. It takes the sequence X2, X1, X1, X2, X2, etc. Just two. X3. That's the ampliation operator. So you give me a set that satisfies those properties and that has an ideal associated with it. So whenever we came across these kinds of these sequence sets that we were defining, one of the first questions you ask is, it doesn't satisfy these axioms, because you want to know what is it coming from an ideal? And it almost always does. Now, the ideal operations that come up a lot for us, and I don't know that people are used to playing with ideals themselves as part of an algebra, some may be, is sum, product. You can always raise ideals to any power, p bigger than zero. There's the tensor, but it's a different kind of tensor, and it's important. Yeah, and it's important, and it has to do with monotonization. You have to first tensor and then monotonize. You take two, forget that they're operators, take two decreasing sequences and tensor them. The tensor doesn't have any special order, well, might. It's X, I, Y, J, and it's certainly not, it's not in a sort of a sequential order, it's in a square order. You have to first monotonize it, and that's the, those represent the S numbers of those guys. There's a quotient, which is a natural definition. All operators, so that all of the J elements times X is in I. And the special case of the quotient is when the numerator is L1. That has a classical name, the Côte d'Or. Okay, just a little way of advertising. This is kind of important for my intuition. It took a long time to prove that the compacts was the sum of two proper ideals, partly because proper ideals are so much less than the compacts, but it is. However, that requires a continuum hypothesis. You can get away with less, Martin's axiom. And I learned just a few years ago in Atlanta when I ran into my co-author that that's actually generated an area in logic called group-wise density, where there's a fairly long list of people who have worked in that area in the last couple of decades. Bloss has continued working in it. Mary Ellen Rudin is one everybody would know, and there's some other names that are alien to me. I won't mention them. Then we come to this property called softness, and it has to do with whether an ideal has roofs or floors, or whether its complement has roofs or floors in the big O sense. And there's quite a bit of structure involved in it, and then we get a main theorem, which I'll only let you look at like for 30 seconds, and then it's Victor's. But that theorem tells you the answer for all the classical ideals we could find in the literature about the codimension problem. But anyway, that's Victor's, and you can't look at it anymore until Friday. Okay. Pardon? But the codimension conjecture is, like I said, is unsettled for all of those. If anyone comes up with a finite but non-one codimension, let us know quickly, and we'll stop all this. Classical ideals, just to review, you'll recognize some of the things. Principle we just talked about. Lorentz is really weighted L1. Now, I'm again describing the... there are no Lorentz ideals until the DFWW, before there were Lorentz sequence spaces, but those are, turns out to be all characteristic sets of ideals. And so now there are Orlik's ideals and Lorentz ideals and Morrison-Cabich ideals. But they fit in the context in an interesting way. So there's Lorentz. Orlik's is this thing. Now there are two Orlik's. This is big Orlik's. Little Orlik's, you put a for all instead of a there exists. So you start with this M, this weight function, and you stick the sequence XN in it, and you put the T in front of that. There has to be some T where that's finite. And that's your Orlik's class, big M, big Orlik's. Marcinkiewicz is the inverse arithmetic mean, which I'll talk about in a minute. Goldberg and Krein includes all of these just by the symmetric norm ideals. Actually includes all of these in some sense, or most of them, I forget whether it's all or most. In the case, but you need to take M convex, and then there's this delta 2 condition, which is relevant there, and then there's this notion of soft pairs Victor will talk about regarding those kinds of things. Well, one of the things I think is very interesting is IMAX is both soft-edged and soft-complemented. Again, you'll find out later what they are. Okay. So, what kinds of objects does Theorem 1 say you should look at? Well, what it says to us we should look at is this 5-chain. So every ideal lies between the AM closure, that's the arithmetic mean, and the pre-arithmetic mean. Here's a definition of pre-arithmetic mean. It's all the elements in C0 star whose averages are an I, and that's the AM interior, arithmetic mean interior, and that's it's this chain holds. The IA is on the right and I pre-A is on the left. We still don't know of a single Clopin that is non-stable. Stable is given here. Stable is when I equals IA, that is no trace. And it's equivalent to I equals pre-I pre-A. So anyway, so we don't know of any Clopins that are not stable. Stables are always Clopin. And we've hunted for a long time for that. How this relates to Theorem 1 comes up very fast. The positive elements in the commutator ideal are the same as the positive elements in the pre-average. So, and you can see fairly quickly then that the largest I sub A is the largest ideal inside the commutator ideal, which is not an ideal, the Lie ideal, but that's really an ideal. And I itself is always the smallest ideal containing that commutator ideal, I B of H. Closed means I equals I bar. By the way, bar is an idempotent, and so is interior, I zero. And the stabilizer, every ideal has a smallest arithmetically stable ideal on top of it. That's it. Here are some examples regarding the classical things. Finite ranks is not stable, closed, nor open. Trace class is AM closed, but not open, or nor stable. Lorentz, when F is decreasing, is Orlik's when M is convex. Lorentz when F is decreasing is AM closed, and Orlik's when M is convex are AM closed. Principles, the following are equivalent, and there's a bunch of players in here. AM stable, AM closed, pi regular, Varga, if and only if no trace, DFWW, and me and Victor, where we have explicit bounds. The soft edge stuff here is about the generator for the principal ideal and so forth. Marcinkiewicz, they're all AM closed, and all averages are AM open. The interior of a trace class, let's see. The interior means you first take A inverse. I think it's zero. Victor, is that right? Zero. Zero. So when you're too small, the interior goes away and is not important. You have to start medium or smallish medium, and then all of a sudden all the structure starts to come into play. Earlier, closures always take you up, so you have plenty of structure above, but you need to be sort of out of the trace class to be able to start seeing the rest of the action. And so there's really some curious properties which I think are just rather fascinating to me, at least. They're topological-like structures, although the complement of an ideal is never an ideal. Now it's, I think my time is up. Can I get another 5 minutes? Is that okay? Say no. Okay. All right. So topological-like structures, Kammerman ideals are not ideals, but you certainly have this, that's the idempotentness of the interior. Dixmier, by the way, used the fact that that quotient is zero, is infinity, and that happens when pi, he's used the fact that pi is a little low of pi sub a. That's an indication of what softness ought to be, and again, an introduction to Victor's talk. And we found that these things are, these curious identities that we needed to develop the theory, that a to the minus n, a to the n, a to the minus n is just a to the minus n. So there's a kind of cancellation going on here, and a to the minus n, a to the n are idempotents. These are all kind of curious identities, and we're wondering if there are more that we're not seeing. Now, this theorem has a long history. It started in 96, and I think I bothered a bunch of you about some various ideas on infinite convexity that I was playing with, and I don't have time to talk about them now, but I can privately. I came up with four. One turned out to be trivial. It happened to be viewed a different way. It was completeness of a normed ideal. But the other three are not trivial. And the last one, the weakest one, is equivalent to arithmetically mean closed. And using that and some techniques that are more general than the finite stuff from finite majorization theory, you can develop an infinite majorization theory for connecting infinite convexity, infinite stochastic matrices, and so forth and so on, and you get this thing, that the closure of the sum is the sum of the closures. And from that, you get this curiosity that every ideal has a largest close inside and a smallest open outside. So, again, smallest open, AM open. AM open, again, yeah. And not to be confused necessarily with soft open, but that's, again, Vic will talk about that. So you have this topological-like stuff, but in the extreme. And the other kinds of questions one might ask about interior double zero and zero, they're all easy, or relatively easy. But this one at least took us a lot of work. Let me skip. Okay, just get through these written notes and then I'll stop. Okay, we learned there's some cancellation things that we found very interesting, and I won't give you the ideal stuff, it's more abstract. I'll just talk about the hands-on sequence questions and what we found out. This was sort of the beginning of the ideal theory for us. Motivation in the beginning, two decreasing sequences. It's trivial that if their averages are equal, so are the sequences. It's false that if their averages are equivalent, then equivalence is the important thing for when you want to play with ideals rather than equal. If they're equivalent, then it doesn't imply that the sequences are equivalent, and a trivial example is summable sequences. They both have their averages equivalent to omega. But the other thing that's sort of obvious is that if you have x equivalent to x sub a, we're talking about regularity here, that's regularity, then you just apply averages both sides and you get that xa is equivalent to xa squared. That's trivial. The other direction was the first surprise here. Okay, notice, by the way, that regularity is this and that x is always dominated by xa, so the question is always whether or not xa is big O of x. That's the issue. And when it is, you have regularity. When it's not, you don't. And in the other direction was the first surprise, an easier proof by Davidson a little bit later. It's also turned out to be a consequence of Varga in 89, but he didn't say it or prove it. It was just a consequence of one of his results, but it's also proven in the FWW. And then Victor and I have a quantitative version. But then the thing that motivated this study was really Virgitsky's question, because averages played an important role in the subject. We stewed over this for several years, Virgitsky and I, and then Victor, about if their second-order averages were the same, because averages are very smoothing. Maybe that implied that the first-order averages are the same. It's not true going from first-order down, as I said before, but maybe because of the smoothing, it was true. This direction, of course, is trivial. And this one, again, I reiterate that is false. So the interesting things are now, and then I'll stop. We found that we found that conditions where on x where you could get this for all y, You could get cancellation, first order cancellation. This is called first order cancellation for all Y. But whenever you have equivalence, you can also ask the same questions for less than or equal to and bigger than or equal to. And they are different kinds of conditions and the same, similar phenomena. If X A is less than or equal to Y A, when can you say X is less than or equal to Y for all Y? With those conditions, and there are conditions, and I don't have time to talk about them now, but I can talk about them privately if you wish. And they have to do with exponential delta 2 conditions. It has to do with asymptotic to logarithm n. Has to do with a certain thing is equivalent to monotone sequence. Those are the kinds of conditions. Now, also, we have conditions about the more interesting ones are the second order equivalence cancellations or inequality cancellations. And then we decided to ask the general question here about, wait, what happens if XA is bigger than G? Is X necessarily bigger than something? It turns out, yes, G can exist sometimes. Like, for example, if it's a power of omega, n to the p, you get that if xa is bigger than 1 over n to the p, then x is bigger than over 1, x 1 over n to the p prime, where, and this was, I never seen this before, 1 over p minus 1 over p prime equals 1. So there's a cancellation thing, but it doesn't always work. However, it always works on the ideal level. So for me, the exciting thing is, sometimes you can get an optimal function underneath, but you can always get an optimal ideal underneath. So ideals then become the answer to certain analysis questions. Where function optimization doesn't exist, ideal optimization answers can. And I found that kind of exciting because it says, hey, wait a second, in the world of analysis, you know, this algebraic type object can play the role of an optimum object. All right, I'll stop here.